the Russian individuals and organizations that Robert Mueller indicted last week, and probably many, many others who aren't in that indictment, have a lot of tools in their campaign influencing toolkit. Social media bots are a big one. Automated accounts swarming over Twitter and popping up in news feeds on Facebook, multiplying and amplifying the message that their programmers want to get out there. The Release the Memo campaign a couple weeks ago, remember that, helped House Republicans try to discredit the Mueller investigation. That was pushed in part by bots. Intelligence chiefs warned Congress that Russians are not done interfering in U.S. politics and that their bots are still lurking social media trying to do just that. Molly McHugh is an expert on information warfare and the narrative architect at New Media Frontier, and she studies the trail from automated tweets to congressional action.
There are so many different bot structures underlying the architecture of social media now that in almost any big story, you will see automated content being promoted. The simplest way to define the two biggest groups is sort of left and right. There's kind of the Bernie bots and or the resist bots. And on the other side, there's kind of the alt-right, far-right group. But it's not always quite so simple as that. But on the Release the Memo case that you mentioned, there were a lot of automated structures that were promoting the hashtag and content relating to the hashtag. And sort of the narrative around it, this idea of the FBI being a bad actor in American society. With the school shooting in Florida, there has been a lot of bot activity on this story from both sides, one very much anti-gun, the other sort of from the opposite side. The liberals are trying to take your guns away. But from both columns of automation, there's been a lot of content promoted over the last couple of days.
So this is to say that whenever there's a big salient news event in American politics or on the American scene, the bots come out pretty much right away from the extremes.
Absolutely.
And why are they there? What purpose are they serving? I mean, presumably, most Americans know what they think about guns or gun control. What are the bots trying to do?
So I think the best way to think about the automation structures in social media is that they are meant to amplify or create the perception that a view is more prevalent than it is. That is why these campaigns can be so effective if they are done well, because that's the point of them. It is not to open your mind to new ideas. It is to harden your views and get you completely activated behind a concept. And the core of most of these structures, it's not born from propaganda. It starts as marketing. Botnets were originally built as ways to promote advertising and sort of make money off of advertising. But of course, once those structures evolve and exist, it's very easy to use them for different purposes.
So talk about the marketing of ideas then when it comes to politics. I mean, a couple of weeks ago or over the last 6 weeks, when the storyline around the Republican memo in the Intelligence Committee and Chairman Devin Nunes and his activity was building up, there was this debate about whether hashtag release the memo came from humans in America or came from Russians, sort of the idea of whether it was legitimate or not. What was that debate really about, and did it matter?
It does matter, and it's an interesting question, but it absolutely matters. And I think it's the problem is that depending on which perspective you're arguing from, you want the answer to be it's Russians who are telling us this, or it's crazy people that are telling us this, or none of it is real, or all of it is real. And it's the combination of those things. Within the Release the Memo campaign, there were absolutely Russian bots. There were non-Russian bots. There were real humans who were just regular Joes on the internet. So it was kind of the layering on of all of these different things, of sort of the real and the fake and the machine and the human, that made the campaign so effective. And what made it gain amplification much quicker is that they very effectively got this in front of verified accounts. So, you know, far right media personalities and others who are not main, it's not Hannity, it's not the main people yet. But in the early phase of the campaign, there were verified accounts on Twitter that picked it up, started promoting it, got that to mainstream right media. And then there was, once Hannity and Trump's son and congressmen started echoing the hashtag and the talking points, it became a very real thing for a specific slice of the media environment of the country. It's not that everybody is sitting on Twitter and that everybody sees these things and that everybody is then convinced by them. And often you hear arguments like that being made from some academics from the side of social media companies, sort of very skeptically saying, come on, you know, only 8% of these ads got to these people, so none of it had any impact on anything. But that doesn't really matter. It's the little piece that is the activation potential that can be churned up pretty quickly by some of these campaigns. It doesn't always work, but when it does work, it's extremely effective because it is about moving a fringe view or narrative from the sort of gray space of digital media world into real media. And once it gets there, it becomes a real thing regardless of where it came from.
Well, Molly, look, I'm a major proponent of free speech, and I'm going to be the first guy to probably oppose you if you say that people shouldn't be on Twitter, even if they're lying. But bots don't have a right to free speech. You know, Twitter is an American company. Why not shut down the bots? Why not say, hey, real people, you can have all the Twitter accounts you want. No bots.
Well, this is exactly the point, is that there are these aspects built into these social media platforms that allow for computational propaganda to be used against people. And again, it can be for marketing something or it can be for selling ideas. And I think this is the thing that's so critical. Yes, people have their views. Yes, people are allowed to promote their views. We may not agree with all of those views. Certainly, that is never going to be the case. But do people have the right to use data-driven, AI-supported computational propaganda against their fellow citizens in order to convince them of things that nobody else really believes? I don't know what the answer is to that. I'd like to say no, but I think we really need to look at it more clearly and without the rose-colored glasses on and absent the sort of First Amendment Trump's all attitude that I think the social media companies have really tried to leverage. And you saw it after the Release the Memo campaign, where the initial response from Twitter to inquiries from the Congress about what was behind this campaign on Twitter was, oh, it was Republicans, you know, everybody has the right to say what they want. But this naivete that's continually put forward, like, oh, we had no idea, it's our first day, they know exactly what they're talking about. This is why they wrote the algorithms the way they did. Social media works exactly the way it is supposed to, which is to keep you within a narrow view echo chamber world so that you stay engaged on the platform and they can make more money off of you and harvest more data from you and sell that for additional money. And this whole cycle is creating a completely corrosive information environment that has absolutely nothing to do with news or information or media or truth in ways that we are used to thinking about it. And when you get into these evaluations of, well, people don't really believe political advertising, so none of this stuff in 2016 mattered, we weren't seeing political ads. You were seeing content promoted from supposed people that were arguing specific views that had nothing to do with a labeled campaign or a PAC or anything else. And that does have a very different impact. When people think other people believe these views, it changes the way that they view them.
Molly McHugh, narrative architect at New Media Frontier. Molly, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard from Molly McHugh there all about computational propaganda. It is being used to try to subvert American democracy. But another question here is, what's the real effect of all this? Bots do sow divisions online, but are they actually changing votes?
There's much less evidence that brief encounters with a single political message can change people's minds in a durable way. We have to be really careful about just assuming that these stories, these ads, these fake news websites were just transforming people's minds. That's not an experience I think that most people had.
That's Brendan Nyhan. He's a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He says bots and fake news are a problem in our politics, but he says when it comes to actual elections, the effect isn't at all clear.
I'm not saying we shouldn't be worried about it. We should be, but I think we should be worried about it for the right reasons and based on solid data. What I'm concerned about is people making loose suggestions that fake news changed the 2016 election outcome, for instance, which is something that's not consistent with what we know about how hard it is to change people's opinions as well as the data we have on who actually went to these websites.
Well, what's some of the best research that you have, some of the best data that's driving the skepticism for you?
Well, there's a whole bunch of research in political science, which is my field, showing that persuasion in campaigns is very difficult. And when people try to change people's minds and change who they'll vote for, it typically fails. And so we should be skeptical of the idea that seeing an article on Facebook for 7 or 10 seconds might have systematically changed the votes of thousands and thousands of people. That intuition is reinforced by the data that my co-authors, Andrew Guess and Jason Reifler and I collected, where we actually were able to observe the websites that people visited. And we found that visits to fake news websites were overwhelmingly concentrated among the set of people who already had extremely conservative information diets. But I think we have to be careful to calibrate our concerns using data and to think about the effects of fake news in this more precise way that I'm proposing.
Give me a sense of what it really does take to change minds in politics. You've been pretty clear, and you're not the first one, Brandon, to say it's really, really hard to change a mind in the political world. What does it take when it's successful?
You know, I don't know if we have a broad answer to that. In some cases, it's the world out there that changes in a way that people ultimately aren't able to deny, right? So you could think about, for instance, the economy being good in the late period of the Clinton administration when Bill Clinton's approval ratings were increasing and even Republicans were acknowledging the economy was quite good. Or you can think about the public turning against a war in Iraq as it became clear that an insurgency was growing there.
Right. So let's move away then from the idea of changing the minds of an independent voter in Iowa to a real world example, Release the Memo, which we just saw on the American scene over the last month or two. That wasn't about changing votes, but it was certainly about something politically salient and pushing lawmakers and the president into a position that people programming bots and driving news, in some cases fake news, or at least with a political agenda, was able to achieve.
That's an example of the more subtle kind of argument you could make about how bots and fake news and other kinds of strategies like this might affect our politics. We find in our research that visits to fake news websites were driven by Facebook. Twitter is not a mass medium in the same way that Facebook is, but it is an effective way to reach political elites and media elites, and in that way potentially have some effect on the national conversation or their actions. And again, we need to carefully differentiate the different players in this sphere. The fake news websites that we analyzed in our study are, to the best of our understanding, created by entrepreneurs who are trying to make money. Facebook and ad networks created a very attractive market opportunity for those folks. Some of these bot efforts are seemingly organized by folks with explicitly political goals. There's no profit motive. It may be Russian-affiliated agents or others who have some kind of an agenda. And that, again, is going to present a different set of problems and potentially a different set of solutions than the fake news that's just trying to make money.
Is it even knowable whether Russian meddling moved votes, changed minds, or changed the outcome?
It's a very difficult question to answer. Any single counterfactual like that is inherently unknowable in some sense. We can use tools of social science to try to understand what might have happened, right? So our study, for instance, allows us to say that the data we observe are inconsistent with visits to fake news websites being especially persuasive in changing vote choice. The Russian hacking is more complicated. You have to think about what might have happened if the Podesta email hadn't been hacked and if that hadn't changed the news agenda in the period before the election. And that's a much harder counterfactual to evaluate, right? It's not that many people were actually downloading the emails, but it was shaping the news agenda in a way that may have been important.
I want to take one final example from just this week. And it doesn't have much to do with moving votes in an election. Fake news accounts have been stating over the last day or two, and bots have been amplifying, that white people are getting assaulted at showings of the new movie Black Panther. It's not true. But when you see that kind of activity on social media, what do you see?
Well, I'm worried. I'm worried that the fake news entrepreneurs out there are incredibly strategic about chasing what performs to make money. It's a terrible situation where we've created these tools that can make it very profitable to inflame us and turn us against each other. I don't know what systematic effects that has, but I do think that people need to be held accountable, particularly at the platforms that have made disseminating that kind of content so profitable and attractive. There will be a trade-off financially for the platforms. Twitter, if it cracked down on bots, its user statistics would look less attractive. If Facebook moves away from pushing news in its newsfeed to more friends and family content and people use the platform less, that could hurt its bottom line as well. That's why it's essential for civil society to keep up the pressure on the platforms to act in socially responsible ways. It will take systematic pressure from the outside to make sure that their arguments win out when it conflicts with those companies' bottom lines.
Brendan Nyhan, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. Brendan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.